When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast for Remainers and Brexiteers alike. Join me, Jonathan Beardmore, every week alongside Alex Davis and Christian Spence as we try and guide you through the choppy waters of Brexit. Hello and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the only podcast which is done from the Members Lounge of the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce. I'm delighted to be joined today with Christian Spence, who has spent the last, week at Conservative Party Conference?
Or Conservative Party Conference last week, Labour Party the week before that. Yeah, I'm all politicianed out, to be honest.
And Alex Davis, who very kindly spent a week investigating the state of politics in Europe from a yacht.
Yes, I was in Greece having a jolly good time on the seas. trying to avoid politics, actually.
So we've been away for a few weeks. Plenty to get started with. Why don't we start with the two party conferences? And we'll go with the Labour Party conference to start with, because it's a little bit easier to describe what their stance on Brexit is now.
Yeah, it's dead straightforward. It was banned. It was the word that shall not be spoken and the topic that shall not be discussed. And of course, this goes back to the political split in Labour. There's a tension between the parliamentary party and the membership, between the MPs and the voters over exactly what Brexit policy should be. So they're managing to square that circle by just saying, we won't discuss it at all, because if we do, it'll open up a rift. And our all-powerful Jeremy Corbyn, who, interestingly, of course, last year's party conference, of course, was dominated by people, MPs saying that Jeremy Corbyn was an utter nightmare, he was a disaster, he was a left-wing communist come Marxist who would destroy not only the country but the party itself. He spent most of this conference being lauded as a very God incarnate. So the party has changed its opinion on all of that. But yeah, dead easy. The Brexit negotiations from Labour, there aren't any.
Or it's all the parties changed its people that make its opinions.
So, well, there's certainly a bit of that going on as well.
It depends. Mm. Now, Just a quick recap, what is the view of the parliamentary party compared to the view of the members? Because this seems to be the kind of the great bone of contention that they have.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the parliamentary party was hugely pro-Remain on the whole, and remains Remain. The party membership is probably a bit more, it's more balanced. I don't think it's necessarily overwhelmingly Leave, but it's a bit more balanced. The voter base is pro-Remain for Labour. But of course, a huge challenge is it's old Labour, it's old working class, kind of traditional Labour vote, is actually quite heavily Leave. And they migrated in the last election really to the Conservatives.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting things which keeps on coming up, which is, what can this North London set, for want of a better phrase, offer the person in Hull or Doncaster?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, and all the major political parties are pretty broad coalitions and splits. Labour has this tension between, as you said, the liberal metropolitan elite in Islington, and it's more traditional working class vote in the northern cities. The Tory has a split between its its urbanite metropolitan wealth creators, I guess you might call them, and its rural, its particularly kind of rural hinterlands and much more farming and traditional communities. But it appears to be a bigger split for Labour. It's a bit of a harder one to hold together.
Yeah, and the interesting one, I think you mentioned this last week, Alex, or when we were last recording, is how the Brexit divide has actually caused another split within everything else. You've got, class, wealth, race, what have you, and now you've got Leave and Remain, and this seems to be tearing apart all the parties as much, if not more, than everything else.
Yeah, it's why I actually think that Labour's current approach is probably the right one for them to take. I think it's kind of smart. Because I think we've said before that whichever party tries to take the helm of Brexit is going to find itself in a tricky situation where it can't please anyone. And so I totally understand why Labour might want to remove themselves from that conversation entirely. I mean, they would obviously have to come up with a plan if they were, there's a an increased threat of a general election or something like that going on. But for the moment, they're kind of just taking the back, stepping on the back foot and just seeing what the Conservatives will do. But I do think actually that even though the Labour's position has always been split and has kind of been changing, you know, even since the manifesto came out, we've seen it change and soften up versus the Tories' position. I think Corbyn's actually done a pretty good job recently in pointing out the hypocrisies of the Tory strategy, even if not presenting an alternative one himself. I mean, we saw this in the House of Commons with Theresa May's speech earlier on this week, which we'll talk about a bit later on. He's doing a pretty good job of of poking holes in their approach.
Yeah, he's found them all, hasn't he? He's found all the weaknesses and has actually kind of clearly identified them now. It's the stuff we've been talking about for a while. But
yeah,
I do kind of wonder if they'd always been fairly good at poking holes in things, but just the overall story around them was more about, you know, lack of policy control, lack of leadership, that kind of thing. And now, it's almost a masterclass in party control.
Yeah, they've been pretty strict on the messaging. And I think, you know, you saw that, I said earlier, you know, the party conference banned any talk of it. Precisely because if it was brought up, it would fracture.
Mm.
It will, if you get into any detail in this, you'll cause a huge fracture. You know, Corbyn is pushing that we have to leave because it's it's the democratic mandate. He'll say, even though that's not what he wanted, because he ended up campaigning Remain when, you know, we know his entire political life has been fighting the neoliberal capitalist bastion that that is the EU. But of course, you know, the vast swathes of the backbenchers were hugely pro-Remain and hugely anti-Corbyn.
Yes, and probably still are.
And probably still are, though they're managing to kind of control their public rhetoric on that now.
Yeah, so we've just spoken about a masterful bit of messaging and party control. How does that compare to the Conservative Party conference?
Well, I think overall, I think the Tories probably had a relatively decent conference. Actually, it was here in Manchester, so I spent quite a bit of Monday and Tuesday at some fringe meetings and talking to different politicians and businesses.
Just out of interest, what were the Chamber of Commerce sending you there to discuss it? Who are the type of people that you were meeting?
Variety of things. Sunday night we hosted a joint reception with Centre for Cities, which is a think tank specifically devoted to urban economic policy and how cities grow. So we were there with a lot of representatives from them, other organisations who do similar kind of work, some of the think tanks and policy specialists, and Sajid Javid, who's the Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government. So he's the man who gave a great speech saying how important devolution is and how we need to move it forward. Little acknowledgement that he's the man who's actually in charge of being able to do that. managed to speak of it all at some disconnect. But that was that. Monday, a huge variety. We covered skills, we covered house building, challenge of SME, construction companies. It's the usual thing with policy conferences. We talk about pretty much everything.
I'm always fascinated by this because obviously we're doing a Brexit podcast, so particularly my focus a lot of things is Brexit. Did you get that feeling that Brexit is starting to creep into these areas of policy, whether it be housing or devolution or anything like that? Or is it just business as usual?
I wouldn't say it's business as usual, but it's Brexit, it's more about kind of what we might call the second order effects. So it's not Brexit itself, it's what might be the concomitant risks or advantages depending on where government ends up. So if we're talking about skills, as we were at one round table, actually Brexit comes onto the agenda because of potentially reduced net migration into the EU, potentially losing EU skilled workers back to their homelands or other EU27 nations over the next couple of years, where migration policy fits into all that. So it was discussed at a remove. No, I didn't touch on anything. We talked about and around Brexit, but actually the none of the ones I was at. I mean, certainly there were plenty of fringes where Brexit was discussed, but from a sheer policy point of view, it's hard, it's complex.
Do either of you have any views? Let's talk about two speeches here. Let's go with the Boris Johnson one first.
I did not watch the Boris Johnson one.
Well done. Congratulations. You missed nothing.
I've got the gist of it, I think, from other people.
Yeah, it's what we saw. It's what we've seen regularly from Boris for the past, since he suddenly decided he wanted to come out in favour of Leave. It's what we've seen from Liam Fox, Secretary of State for International Trade. It's the A-level essay on why free trade is good.
Did he mention the corn laws?
I can't remember, but it wouldn't surprise me. You know, certainly as we're here in Manchester, you know, it's a good place. It's just the usual rhetoric. Free trade is good. Look at what we did about bringing tariffs down. Yeah, cool, but that's just not what That's not where the focus for all of these conversations needs to be. Because Boris, that was a political speech. Don't forget, he'd spent the last 2 weeks getting himself into great deep piles of doo-doo by contradicting the Prime Minister and stated party policy. I think what he needed to do was save his job rather than set up any kind of strategic government plan.
I just can't work out the Boris thing. Feels to me as if he's desperately trying hard to stay relevant, which is weird for a foreign secretary. You'd think a foreign secretary is automatically relevant. And I can't work out if he helps the Brexit argument, hinders it. I mean, I can't even work out if he's any good electorally anymore.
No, I think he probably used to be. I think there was a slice of the Conservative Party. I think actually if you talk to even to some Labour voters, there was a slice that kind of liked him. Mm. But I think it's that kind of like in the way it's kind of fun to, you know, have a chat with Jacob Rees-Mogg, and it's kind of fun to have a chat with you know, some more of those sort of characters. Farage, you know, if you ask people actually of all politicians you'd love to have dinner with, actually Farage should be pretty close to the top of the list.
Yeah.
I have sheer damn interest. You know, the ability for one man to take a one policy party and drive it to the top of the national agenda is a colossal achievement, whatever you think about the outcome. But I think increasingly he's in that kind of space. It's that, well, it's interesting because he's kind of funny and a bit bonkers, but I don't want him actually running
anything. He's the wild card, isn't he?
Yeah. having him as Prime Minister would be fun, if rather tempestuous.
Yeah.
But it'd be fun if you're quite happy with, you know, casual racist slogans being dropped through speeches. And of course, he got called out when he was in I forget where he was now. He went to a visit in the temples in Myanmar. And was busy reciting a bit of poetry which sort of talks about the English Empire invasion and taking everything over, and had to be stopped talking by his advisor, who said this is not appropriate. And,
yeah.
You know, but why? What's wrong? It's like, we're trying to move beyond the colonial past, Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, I would really struggle as his advisor, because I'm not nearly well enough read to recognise when he'd be on one of his soliloquies about colonial pasts.
I think increasingly he's just seen as a bit, increasingly as just dangerous, essentially. You know, it's, and certainly, you know, we've seen commentators of both sides, I think, in the past few weeks that, you know, fundamentally the only thing Boris is really looking for here is his own ego and his own career. If he thinks he could get to the top job and stay in by suddenly flipping to being a Remain supporter, it wouldn't surprise me if he did it.
Yeah. There is another speech, Theresa May's speech. Now, just for the record, I have seen both the Tory and Labour Party leaders' speech and conference every year for the past 10 years. I have not been able to bring myself to even watch this. So if you can just very quickly tell us what impact it had, and also did it have anything at all of substance regarding Brexit? Because I don't believe it did. Read the transcripts.
It was very long.
It was very long.
Most of that was coughing, to be fair.
Yeah, 45-50 minutes. There was obviously the issues with coughing, which I think she responded to pretty well on Twitter actually afterwards. Yep. Mm-hmm. Posting pictures of all the Gaviscon and medication and stuff like that.
It's the poor aide that had to run out and buy all that Gaviscon to take the picture.
Yeah. Obviously the thing with the comedian handing the P45 over, the letters falling off the wall. It didn't go great. It was a bit cringy to watch. And the thing is, Brexit wasn't included very much in it. I think the speech itself was pushing 9,000 words, I think. And only about 400 odd of them were about Brexit. And it was essentially, once again, a kind of reiteration of all the same notes that she had in the Florence speech. I'm not sure that there was anything particular to be pulled out of it in terms of Brexit.
It is a Brexit, no, nothing. And even the policies that she did announce, you know, I think we're struck by kind of a speech of two halves. You know, the first half was a lauding of the importance of free markets and how capitalism has liberated the poor from the world, and that free markets are the way to move society on and help people get richer. And then the second half was about intervening in free markets where they don't produce the result that government wants. So we went from a very open market, you know, sort of traditional libertarian kind of view of the power of free markets in the first half, to price caps on energy bills, to intervening in housing with Help to Buy. Now, housing needs intervention and fixing, but a massive demand-side push is not the way to solve a supply-side problem.
Yep.
That will just make everything worse. Of course, well, that'll do well. It'll do nicely for house builders, undoubtedly. We saw their shares, rise on the back of it. But it ain't going to do anything to fix the market overall. So all a bit contradictory, really. And as you said, combined with coughing P45s and the set literally disintegrating behind her as she spoke, it doesn't kind of portray a prime minister who has the look filling the sails. I think that's the challenge.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm not going to go into a diatribe of what worries me about Theresa May, because it is long. I think quietly the canary in the coal mine for all this Brexit stuff might actually be Philip Hammond, because he does stuff. He doesn't say much, but he does stuff. So this week he's been criticised for not having a contingency. Why is this important?
We've had headlines recently that the government is once again starting to look seriously into the implications of no deal. And this was kind of flipped on its head by Philip Hammond, who came out and said that he's not going to allocate budget towards looking into the implications of no deal until it's absolutely necessary, because he thinks it's an irresponsible use of taxpayer money. And it's a weird addition to the conversation, because you have to ask the question whether they are seriously planning for no deal because they think that it's something that might happen, or whether we're going back to this whole we need to push the idea that we're happy to do this as a negotiating tactic. And I think what Philip Hammond was trying to do was, he essentially said we're not going to look into this just to make a statement. So we'll only put the money towards doing it if we think that there's a serious threat of it happening. He's been very open in the past about, you know, his opinion that he thinks no deal would be a terrible way to go. But I think it has significant implications that he's announced that he's not going to put this money forward. Because it does take weight off that whole negotiating argument that we're just pushing this idea forward to strengthen our hand. But the thing is, I think the EU realises that we are completely unprepared for no deal. And I even think that throwing a few billion at it would not make us prepared for no deal whatsoever. If we were going to seriously prepare for no deal, it would take years. And I think the EU knows this. And I think the comments that Donald Tusk made today or yesterday kind of back this up, you know, where he's saying that if things haven't really moved on by Christmas, that's probably the point which we should start talking more seriously about this, because they realise that it's going to be a massive financial investment is going to be needed, and a lot of time is going to be needed for us to be able to adopt to that situation if it comes to it.
Yeah. I mean, this is just completely off topic, but a thought I've just had. When you say a massive financial commitment, are we talking a massive financial commitment on the scale of, say, the banking crisis financial commitment?
Not necessarily in terms of finance, because that would depend on what kind of the government's economic response is to what no deal means. Now, there's a variety of forecasts out there in terms of looking at kind of, you know, economic impact of an absolute break. None of them come out better than about -7.5%, -9% GDP impact, which would give you an economic crash larger than 2008.
Which is about 5%.
Yeah, a few estimates go wider. The World Bank did some new numbers this week. It puts a flipping to WTO trade terms would remove 50% of our trading goods and 60% of our trading services. So that would take about 14% of the UK economy away. So those are numbers which are, well, you know, the kind of baseline estimates, the median estimates are worse than the financial crisis in 2008. The worst case, but the World Bank estimates would put us at worse than the 1929 recession. In which case, government's mobilisation to try and support the economy would have to be unbelievably large.
Yes.
To try and make any inroads into any of that. But I think it's more about the investment required to, if we're going to go down the no deal route, what is it you now need to put in place?
The new systems that are required to handle that, I think are the big one. Essentially, in the short term at least.
Yeah, so where, you know, we're preparing for no customs union deal. No, you're not, because you need capacity to check every lorry that comes into and out of Dover, Hull, etc. And you need those places and a new computer system in place in the next 18 months.
Yeah. Which is
that
great.
Is an unbelievable level of investment to it, if you can even do it. If it's even possible.
Yeah, if there's
need to throw a hell of a lot of money.
If there's an off the shelf solution somewhere,
yeah,
it might be possible. Otherwise you have to be commissioning computer systems, which
I'm just acquiring land and buildings and training people. You know, we say it takes 12 months to fully train up customs searching officers to be able to do that stuff. You know, we need to be hiring these people now in the event of, and certainly we needed to be pouring concrete at Dover a year ago if we were genuinely preparing for no deal.
Yeah.
So, one of the things which strikes me is there is a talk of no deal. And when we, even even have a rudimentary discussion of no deal, it's quite clear to me that this is just simply a no. It simply won't happen.
And that's kind of always been our judgment, that it's so catastrophically bad that just neither side would allow it.
Just practically, it couldn't be done. I mean, it simply just couldn't be done.
I mean, it would cause economic chaos, absolute economic chaos. On both sides, we would suffer more because of the relative share, but it would cause colossal problems for European countries and companies in those countries.
So, I guess where I'm going with this is, with that in mind, why are we hearing, and particularly over the last week, a lot more politicians on both sides advocating that no deal is more likely? And are they talking about, you know, a 1 in 2,000 chance going to a 1 in 1,999 chance? I mean, what is the point in this?
It's mainly been commentators and journalists, basically since Theresa May made her speech in the Commons this week, which reiterated again much of what was said in Florence, but there are a couple of new additions which mainly came out actually in the MP's questions afterwards, and it seems to be that the government's approach, I've described it as the government backing itself into a corner, and I think what's happening is it's pushing us down one of two routes, one of two possibilities. I think the chance of us getting a deal which satisfies all our red lines and all the EU's red lines and makes everyone happy, you know, has never been high. But I think the chances of that happening now are less than they've ever been. And what is more likely is either that we exit without a deal, or either that we exit essentially on the EU's terms, at least in the short term. I mean, if we think about the transition arrangement which Theresa May is asking for now, what we're essentially asking for is that we basically continue on all the same terms that we would be under if we maintained membership. She wants everything to remain exactly the same in terms of trade, customs agreements, things like that. But she wants everything to remain in status quo mode whilst we are outside the EU and outside the single market and outside the customs union. And Theresa May is putting this forward as her offer to Brussels for them to accept or rebut or whatever. And it's not an offer because we haven't laid out exactly, you know, the systems which we would like to see put in place to make this work. But what it seems to me is happening is that we are essentially capitulating to the EU, but the government is trying to frame it in such a way that we are actually kind of winning. And it's a and I think this is why people are suggesting that the chances of no deal are going up, is because we're not getting any closer to each other. And, you know, we've basically put the same offer on the table two or three times now, and Brussels have come back every time and said, this isn't good enough. And, you know, we change it slightly. So there was a slightly stronger commitment to maintain our budget contributions, for example, when she spoke in the House of Commons. But May puts this on the table as an offer for the EU to then reject or to go along with. And from the EU side of it, they haven't changed what they're asking for, basically since the talk started, because to do that is very, very difficult. You know, Barnier needs to go to the 27 and get an agreement that they're going to change tack. And it's much, much more difficult for them to do that than it is for us to do that. And what I see happening at the minute is that essentially we are asking to be put in a situation where we are still completely subservient to the EU. We fall out of all its institutions, lose all of our influence, at least for 2 years. And everything remains exactly the same, but at the same time, we're technically at the single market and the customs union. You know, there were some MPs asking great questions around the technicalities of how that works, and essentially the government's response is to just use such muddled language that no one can really work out what they're asking for.
So essentially, the deal that you're describing here is we will give up the EU institutions like medicines agency, so on and so forth, and our voting rights. In return, you've got to not call us a member, but give us all of the benefits.
Yes, yeah. That's pretty much what it seems to me we're asking for.
That seems a fairly straightforward deal to hammer out then.
That's doable. Considering there is absolutely no legal precedent for that situation, it creates massive issues on the EU side of things because it's unprecedented in law. Theresa May said she won't go along something like CETA, she won't rely on membership of the EEA, so none of the structures that are already in place will be the ones for us. It has to be something totally bespoke. Even though it won't be something totally bespoke. But I think this goes back to the idea that
how long would this bespoke deal take to work out? Is that the idea of the transitional arrangement?
Well, I mean, this is the whole point, because they just keep... It's all about, oh, it's very easy because we share, you know, and again, actually, in her speech, you know, she reiterated this, we share all the same laws, everything's equal. And it's like, yes, but the challenge of a trade deal, you know, an enhanced, you know, trading relationship deal, is it's about how you manage those things not diverging over time.
Mm.
You know, she said, oh, we might want to diverge in sectors and all the rest of it. And the EU has said, we are not negotiating sector-specific deals. You forget it. They're just not interested.
Yeah. But, I mean, at some level, they're going to have to be interested at some point. And the thing I don't get about the EU negotiations is I simply don't know where we're at. So, you know, if someone asked me where we're up to with with citizens' rights, I couldn't tell you what the sticking points are.
Yeah, oh, it's all there actually. It's all published. So yeah. there's a nice table in red, yellow, and green on the Commission's website that shows where we've agreed and where there are still divergences and all the rest of it. But it is mostly actually us capitulating to them on all of those issues where we've gained ground, because essentially, Alex said earlier, the huge challenge is the negotiating guidelines have been set by Parliament and European Council, they've been ratified, they've been given to Barnier. He has to deliver in scope of those. Him trying to get an agreement with us outside of that scope involves going back to the European Council and getting unanimity across all 27. And what we're seeing is some nations in the EU are now starting to realise a bit of the strength they've got. So we've seen comments from Barnier recently saying actually he was minded to move on beyond citizens' rights, because we're about 95% of the way there now, apparently. He said, I'm not minded to move on. We're close enough that we can start talking about that transition. But Germany and France pushed back on that. He said, well, you know, I'm starting to think about, you know, we should be ready to move on to more transitional talks because there aren't too many sticking points left. But again, Germany, France, one other nation state, I can't remember, are realising actually they've got a unanimous veto. Each member state has a veto here.
Mm.
And actually we can, you know, they've probably got the most political leverage over a massive global economy that they will ever have. At this point. So why would you lose that opportunity? From their point of view, or I mean, yes, yeah, so it's understand how it frustrates us and what we're trying to achieve, but from their point of view, it's perfectly rational behaviour.
Now, there is, would you call it a split in EU thinking? Because there was the Danish finance minister, I believe, came out and saying, right, it is time to talk trade. So, you know, just because let me phrase this a different way. Does the veto basically obstruct people doing stuff? So are France and Germany going to be using the veto to stop people like Denmark moving things on?
Well, potentially, yeah, because you need... It doesn't need unanimity at the European Council or whatever the final deal is. It needs qualified majority vote, so you'll need around about two-thirds of the population equivalent of the EU.
Two-thirds of the population.
That's how QMV works. It's not about two-thirds of countries, it's two-thirds of population equivalents.
Right.
Or economic equivalents, one of those two. So essentially, Denmark on its own cannot force this through onto the next stage if you've got other ones. But then it will go to whatever the deal is, European Council recommends it, the European Parliament then has to pass it. So you've got all the possibilities of the European Parliament potentially turning it down. And don't forget, they did a very cheeky little vote a couple of weeks ago saying that they thought discussions weren't in a right place to move forward in transition. Now, they have no say in this, actually.
Yeah.
That was really cheeky. All this is a decision that's been delegated to Task Force 50 in Barnier. The Parliament has no say in all that, but they wanted to shoot a message across the bow. Interesting, it got moved. It came on the Tuesday before Theresa May's speech. It was the Parliament was trying to schedule it for 30 minutes before she spoke, which is, you know, a nice... But that gives you a sense of where the temperature of the European Parliament is here on all of this. And, of course, whatever comes out will be a change to international treaties, which means all 28 member states, us included, will have to pass the change in their own domestic parliaments. Some places have subnational parliaments which have to be talked to for constitutional reasons. So you remember when, was it Flanders?
Wallonia
nearly brought the CETA agreement down on its own. That is still a possible play.
Now, I understand that's changed, actually. That is no longer the case because they were so shaken by the CETA agreement. I think they have actually removed that stipulation.
Mm-hmm. So these are the challenges that are coming through. So it is perfectly possible that, you know, individual member states will want to exert their force. Though for now, it's a decision for Barnier. You know, the European Council has devolved all the power on this to Barnier. It's his call until we go back for the European Council meeting, at which we've already been told, apparently, the recommendation is we cannot move forward.
Right, brilliant. It does, I mean, not that we didn't know this already, but it does really highlight the power of Germany in all this.
Just yeah, absolutely. I mean, don't forget, Germany is the single largest contributor to the net contributor to the EU budget. Ahead of us.
Largest population?
Slightly larger than us. Not much, but slightly. And so, you know, it is the one that will be asked to bear the budget gap when we go, essentially. And don't forget, it's already written hundreds of billions of euros to Greece, which it's currently trying to pretend it will get back. But we know in reality all that is going to be written off.
Yeah. Now, does Germany's position change because of the general election? Because we've not actually spoke about the general election yet.
Yeah, I think we may have touched it actually when you and I chatted in just a couple of weeks ago. I don't think it does, to be honest. Brexit was not an issue in the German general election.
Mm.
And actually, it's not an issue in most European news. I started following European newspapers much more. They're not talking about it. This is not an issue for the average punter in Europe.
Does it change Europe's negotiating position? Or does something fundamentally change in their mindset when an event an event like the German election, which actually wasn't that seismic, but what could be seismic, would be something like Catalonian independence. Does that make any difference whatsoever?
I don't think so, really. I mean, my gut reaction is, you know, we've talked about this before, the EU's position from Council to 27 to Parliament to Commission is exactly what it was the day after we voted to leave. They've been absolutely clear about what they want to see, and they've been incredibly clear about what they will not accept. That's not shifted, and I don't see any kind of national issues particularly having any impact on that.
No.
You know, the EU will protect itself as an entity, A, because it wants to, because of the political project and the importance of that. I think its experiences with Greece give you a sense of just how far it is prepared to push its own power. Whatever side you're on, it is not unreasonable, I think, to come to the conclusion that the EU was perfectly happy to concede a quarter of an economy and half of a population to dust to preserve the integrity of its systems. That's a harsh call, but it's, it was clear they were debating this kind of stuff. Is it right that the EU, to protect itself, to make sure it doesn't lose a Eurozone member? The spin-off of that is you need to crush one of the economies.
Yeah,
that is what they did.
You could make a very similar argument as the Greece one for Italy, for Spain, for basically most of Southern Europe.
Italy and Spain are a bit different just because of the sheer scale. You're coming out of the Eurozone crisis in 2013. Lots of people say, "Well, look, you know, we can sort Greece out, but if Italy goes, they're stuffed."
Yeah.
For all of Italy's political and economic problems, it's the eighth largest economy in the world. It's the third largest in the Eurozone.
I think it's got the largest bond market in the world, which is incredible.
Because they always say, Europe can afford to run Greece itself if it needs to in terms of cash terms. It cannot afford to bail out Italy, it cannot afford to bail out Spain. Those economies are too large. So you've got a slightly different scale on that with the size of the UK. The EU's vision has always been, look, you're the ones who wanted to go. And you see that in the, you know, there's some lovely psychoanalysis in that, I think, in the Barnier statements and the Juncker statements, which say, look, the UK has made a sovereign decision to walk away from the institutions and treaties of the European Union, and we, the EU, must respect their right to do so. Now, that's kind of very cold legalese in one way, but it's also reaffirming, look, it's, all of our structures stay the same. No matter what happens to you, we don't really need to do anything.
But of course,
all of our stuff stays intact.
See, but of course, that is fundamentally wrong, isn't it? Because they're going to have a massive budgetary hole. Things are going to have to change, and they're looking to change,
and they want to change. Yeah. And the Five Presidents report talks about greater integration, all that kind of stuff, and we see more noises from Tusk on all that. But the truth, I think, a kind of hard truth is, it will be much easier for Europe to do those changes without us.
I think
we're the body that's always held that back.
And I think this is one of the most important points of all, which is maybe if we got out of their way and we can do it in an amicable fashion, actually we'll be both better off for it because they can federalise and we can trade and all the rest of it.
Possibly. I think and there's a colossal amount of caveats on us coming out better on how we do it. I think we've always maintained it's possible. I wouldn't say at the moment it's probable, But certainly I could see benefits for the EU. I mean, it loses a massive nation out of its trading power. You know, that will, you know, taking us out will affect its ability to do big deals in the future, because you're taking out a massive global contributor. The other kind of more liberal northern European economies will be worried about where the EU might go without us, because we were the big break on massive integration and you know, more socialist interventions, more market-centric interventions. In terms of, at least in terms of where the, if we say the bureaucracy wants to go in the future, us being out probably makes life easier for them.
Completely agree.
That goes back to why I think that the current approach doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah.
It's because the transition that we're asking for is basically to remove our influence from the EU, but essentially for us to remain a member. So the EU can go and do whatever it wants, but we will have no influence and won't be able to slow it down anymore. And then my thinking on it is that we'll get stuck in that position for a long time.
And that's because, a huge risk for us. Yeah, as an economy, it's a huge risk.
Which is why I think the approach is so silly, really. Because the government is setting itself up, first of all, to negotiate. Theresa May is saying that the transition isn't going to be bespoke. It's just going to be on the same terms as membership. But if it's going to be on the same terms as membership without us being in the single market, the customs union, or the EEA, or having something like CETA, then it is bespoke, because that position doesn't currently exist. It is bespoke, and it is something which is going to have to be negotiated. So they're setting themselves up to negotiate a bespoke transition arrangement, only then once we're in that transition position to then go and negotiate a bespoke free trade agreement more comprehensive than CETA or the South Korea one. So we're setting ourselves up for two periods of negotiations here. And Theresa May, whilst previously saying that the transition period would be time limited, actually said in the Commons this week that it would be, according to what they know currently, it looks like it will take about 2 years to do this, but it's kind of open-ended. It will just last for however long it takes for us to go from that step to the next one.
And we know, of course, the EU won't accept that. In their negotiating agreements, any transition has to be time limited. That's strict from their side too.
Yeah, but everything's got to be time limited. So it wouldn't surprise me one bit if the negotiation window expands. Same with the, you know, you can see it saying, right, it's going to be time limited to 3 years, and after 2 years.
Well, I mean, actually, extending the negotiating period is exactly what we should be doing.
Exactly. Yes. That's a massive reason why the current strategy doesn't make any sense, because everyone seems to have forgotten that we can go and ask for Article 50 to be extended. So,
or as it is found out, well, as it is reminded to us this week, revoked.
Yes,
so we can. I can honestly see us going up to like the day before leaving, and then actually we'll have that back probably.
Yeah, I don't think it would create a great deal of political capital for the next set of round of negotiations if there's any in the future. I think the other challenge, or the transitionary period, as sort of Theresa May's putting it, is that it's, you stay in everything for the benefits, but you have absolutely no influence. We've no MEPs, we've no representation at council, all the rest of it. What an opportunity for the EU. What an opportunity to say, actually, what rules might we put through in that period where the UK is part of us but has no say? Mm. What a great opportunity to say, actually, Euro trading must only take place in the Eurozone, and we have no representational accounting to fight back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of, you know, bold and ambitious and slightly scary stuff. But kind of the EU in its own interest would be bonkers to not try.
This is why I kind of don't agree with the people who are currently saying that no deal is getting more likely. I think what is becoming more likely is that we will leave essentially on exactly the EU's terms. But the EU will allow us to kind of sell the idea that we've won to the people. And I think I kind of feel like that's the government's current strategy.
Double messaging.
Because it's put itself in such a corner now. And essentially what it's asking for of the EU is for us to be put into a worse position than membership, a worse position than being Norway. It's the worst position that currently exists, essentially being party to everything that the EU does, but with having no influence over it. That would be a massive win for the EU. That would be the punishment, almost. But the way that the government is kind of playing with the language and saying, well, you know, this is the right thing to do and blah, 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 they're currently trying to sell that position as a win for us. And it makes me wonder whether the EU going to catch on to this and go, you know what, you've won, you've done really well here, yeah, we'll give you that transition period you're asking for. Because really, we gain absolutely nothing from that position.
Now, if you want to be completely Machiavellian, let's talk about the Euro, you just mentioned it, Christian, trading.
Eurobond clearing. Yeah.
Thank you. What other areas might the EU decide to tamper with? Fishing, that kind of thing?
Fishing. I mean, yeah, there's potentially that. Huge. I mean, interestingly though, Theresa May said in answers to her questions in the House the other day that the UK would in 2019, despite the transition agreement, would find itself outside CAP and the CFP, Common Agricultural and Common Fisheries policies. So actually, we're not underneath everything. It's not a status quo transition at all. You come out of that. Now, actually, of course, being party to single market and all that that brings, but not being party to CAP and CFP looks very, very like the EEA.
Mm. Yep.
That basically is EEA membership.
Yep.
So that's sort of an interesting one. It's just trying to piece this together, but it's the lack of clarity over all this.
Do you think, I mean, I know I've been maybe a little bit more optimistic than you two. But I do believe there is some clarity underneath all this. There is a centralised plan. They're just not allowed to talk about it or disseminate it to the public. And I think that's fairly reasonable if that is the case, because we can't have our negotiating position out there publicly, because you've got the dual problem of negotiating with the public and then also negotiating with Europe. So
well, I think, though, that the whole problem is this trying to maintain two separate negotiation strategies.
Mm.
So, you know, we saw it from Barnier's comments earlier this week and from Tusk. One of the reasons they're getting jittery about the ability to get a deal away, because they've said, no, it's not going to happen in October, it may not even be on the agenda for the October Council meeting, is actually we don't believe that there's a political stability to actually deliver on this. How much power does May actually have to determine all of this? So, why is she asking that? I said, well, actually, don't forget, it's almost like the UK government forgets that all of our colleagues in the EU read our newspapers and see our TV. Because every time Theresa May stands up in Florence and says, we're going to go for a transitional deal, it's going to be stable, it's going to be all this, and then stands up in Parliament and says something else,
she undermines
herself and the UK's vision every time. Because it's almost like, oh, I'm talking to the UK, so you know, Barnier won't hear this. But of course, everything is being reported back, and of course, everything's being analysed to the nth degree. So every time we say something different, every time the Prime Minister says X to the EU, Y to the UK, and then Boris Johnson says Z, and David Davis says Z1, the EU is quite rightful to say, actually, what is your position?
Mm. Yeah, it's
true. How can we have confidence? What are you actually trying to achieve?
You know, I still think, and I mentioned it a long time ago, the best option, both politically and practically, the Tory party, would have been to open this up to being cross-party. That's the only way we could get a stable position and not worry about the politics within the nation.
Yeah, I agree. Because, as you say, if there is a plan behind this, and I'm not sure that there is, but if there is one, it's not a very good one. Based on the evidence that we've got currently. And I think if there is one, it's only been formulated based on being pushed into that position from past mistakes, essentially. Which is why I keep saying I think the only way for this to work properly now from this point is for there to be a total reset of approach and red lines and everything.
Now, is it too late for it to be cross-party?
I mean, technically, no. I think the huge challenge, of course, for Labour is it's seeing what the Tory party is going through as it tries to reconcile this, and it knows that it's opening itself up to cross-party government. We'll do all of that to the Labour party.
I don't think Labour wants in.
Well, that's why I kind of want them in.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we will see. Right, gents, what is going on this week with the Chamber of Commerce? Obviously, you've come off all the hectic stuff from the Tory party conference. What's going on now?
Hectic stuff. Well, interesting. Just after, so we're recording this on Wednesday this afternoon, I'm off down to a meeting with a few business and representative organisations, a couple of companies we're taking, and one of the permanent secretaries to the Home Office.
Oh, wow.
To talk Brexit migration policy. So that's a chance, really. That's Home Office in listening mode, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So we're taking a couple of our members down there to talk about that. So the number of roundtables and engagement events is increasing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like Brexit's coming back on the agenda, you know, behind the scenes at least, but I'm certain in a more public sense soon. From us and BCC down in London, we went through a period where everyone kind of got bored of it and nothing was happening, but it really is kicking up a gear now, and I think things are getting scary. So I think Brexit's going to enter the enter the conversation in an hour output in a bigger way.
Yeah, I think so, as we get towards Christmas. Yeah.
Well, one podcast that never gets bored of Brexit is the Last Week in Brexit podcast. So if you do like what you've heard, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Beardmore. You gentlemen are where?
At GMCC underscore Christian.
I'm at GMCC underscore Alex.
Yeah, and if you've got any technical questions, fire into those last two Twitter accounts. Until next week, we will see you then. Goodbye.